I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel. The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, everybody, it's Devin.
And Kate.
Welcome to Med Crimes.
Ready for round two, baby.
You want to know what I almost did there? And I can't
always.
Even... It's so cringy. I told you that I was like listening to a couple old episodes. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, when do I stop doing the Twilight Zone theme? Thank God I stopped. We're at least into Janine Jones and it's still going on. So
I
like,
feel like it was like
four,
twice, like two or three times.
We're
max.
At least at four. So,
okay. Well, you're at five now because you just did it. So
crap.
Please don't sue us.
I had to bring it back for the other people.
Oh, my God. It's kind of just like a classic, iconic Devin situation now, you know?
The good old days.
It's one of those things we can just put on the shelf of little Devin comments, like the apple cider donut thing and the twinkle the lights, feed the Santas thing. You know, it's all just part. It's
that
all just
first,
a big bundle of you.
That first episode really had a lot of zingers.
It really was. I have listened to it more times than I think I would care to admit. And it is equal parts exciting, cringy, and just generally appalling. So we're all very sorry. And actually, the number of you guys that are still like messaging us saying, oh, hey, like we're starting from the beginning and we love you. I'm like, are you sure?
Someone just told me that the other day that they were like, you know, looking
you
for a
sure?
new podcast. And of course, I put the plug in for us and whatever. And then it was like, and I did the whole like, I don't know where you're going to start. But if you start at the beginning, like, you know, bear with us, yada, yada. And she go, oh, I'm starting with season one, ep one. I'm like, oh, good luck.
Boy, at least like listen to an older one first and then go back to the beginning so you know what you have to power through and look forward
Correct.
To.
That's
at least
so much better. Yeah.
So
here we are.
Here we are. And we have a couple of Patreons.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. We have Lunar Kissed. Hey, Lunar Kissed.
That's interesting.
Yeah,
like
anarchist, but Lunar Kissed. That's
wow.
cool. And then we have Cassie Stam. Hi, guys. Thank you for joining.
Hey. Thanks for being a part of the fam.
And you guys have a critter, and you guys are Malakim. And Malakim are angels. And actually, they're like a specific order of angels that descend from like Jewish mysticism, who they're typically like an authority figure among the other like more lowly angels. And they're often tasked with delivering important messages. So you guys are Malachim. So ready to dive into this crazy pat too with you guys, because I'm looking forward to putting this douchebag where he belongs.
I'm kind of like, all right, like
it's a heavy one. It's a heavy
one. Yeah, well, for sure. And just like, you know, the scene was so gory.
Yep.
Like, and just so, you know, and it's just, I'm having a hard time envisioning someone doing that to their children and to their pregnant wife. And it's
I feel like, you know, there's such a disconnect between, you know, where he was in his youth to now. And, you know, it almost makes you wonder, was there like some underlying, you know, ASPD or like sociopathy situation? Because,
like,
you know,
what took the turn?
You know, and I say if he really did this, which he was convicted, I'm going to spoil that for you guys. He was convicted. So that's why we're not saying allegedly. But there's still some controversy around his conviction, which we'll obviously get into. You know, if that's the truth and he did do this, like, how does one compartmentalize, like, committing a crime like this and then going and laying down and draping your arm across your wife who is pregnant with your third child and you've had this, like, long, you know, romantic partnership with, and, you know, feigning alarm about your children, like, please go check on my kids, when, like, you were just in their room bludgeoning them. And it's, I don't know, there's something very sick and alarming and very scary that, like, a human being can be capable of that.
Right.
So that's just, like, my thoughts, you know?
It's just...
it's a lot. It's a lot.
I just have, like, such a disconnect, and I just, yeah. I don't know. I've been thinking a lot of the last couple days. Just like, this is, I can't wait to get older. I don't even know why how I'm even bringing this up right now when we're talking about a guy mutilating his family. But
that's okay.
I have to just say, it's such a privilege to grow old.
Mm-hmm. I love like that? Hearing you say that. It's so refreshing because there's so much like taboo about like aging. And like, why can't we just like love and accept the fact that we're in new eras of life? And like, I'm excited about the future.
There is so many young people out there that don't get to grow old.
That's so true. And I think
it's such a privilege. And I've just been thinking about my family and what, you know, just, I don't even know why I'm saying this right now. It had to be said.
I think because those lives were cut tragically short.
Probably.
And, like,
and
you know, they could have,
you hear god-awful stuff like this. You hear terrible things like this. And you can't help but think about your own family and just what you're so blessed to have. You know, and it just brings me to, you know, our beloved James Vanderbeek, you know? And
that's
sad. You know what I mean? And it's just such a privilege to grow old. And I just had a birthday, right? The reflection. And I am not afraid to turn 40 next year. You know?
Good for you. You know,
I think the only thing that might make me afraid is I don't want to be one of those people getting cancer in my 40s.
Yes.
You know, that's pretty much like it's a privilege to grow old.
It is. I think like doing this podcast, you know, we read and talk about a lot of people who don't get that privilege and, you know, their lives get tragically cut short for one reason or another, you know, whether it be because they're a victim of a crime or, you know, have a catastrophic illness of some kind. But it does, like, that's one of the things that have come out of this podcast for me is, like, you know, I've always appreciated my family, but I feel like I appreciate, you know, the little moments a little bit more. And I appreciate that I'm here to be with them and watch it and see them grow and everything. And there's so many people that can't. And, you know, you mentioned James Vanderbeek, and I'm going to go ahead and say the stuff that's coming out of the Epstein files.
Ugh.
Which I'm not going to get into because there's just too much of it. And it's all really shocking. And that's not even the right word because I don't really have a word for what's in there. But the amount of lives that were allegedly cut short and just erased off this earth without a thought, without a wink, without anything, you know, it just makes you makes you think, makes you wonder about, you know, what actually goes on. You know, it's not getting talked about enough. So I'm just going to say it. Epstein files. Keep talking about it. Keep the conversation going because nobody is talking about it enough.
It's not going anywhere anytime soon, in my opinion. I think all the trying to get it to go away is just fueling the fire. So
I hope so. I hope so, because I want to hear more about it and I want there to be outcomes and I want some really important people to get their asses handed to them. All right. So last week, just in a brief recap, obviously listen to part one if you haven't. Same trigger warnings apply here because we are going to be, again, sort of like reopening this discussion about this young woman in her 20s who was brutally murdered when she was 5 months pregnant with her third child, and her two existing children, who I believe were 3 and 6 at the time, who got tragically murdered brutally in the same manner as their mom. And the one survivor of the home invasion was Dr. Jeffrey McDonald, who was an accomplished physician and Green Beret in the Army. And the family had this like beautiful, idyllic life on Fort Bragg, which is a military base down in North Carolina. And he, as he was recovering in the hospital, made statements alluding to, you know, there being these 4 hippies that invaded their home. And the word pig was like scrawled on their headboard in blood. And he is making statements trying to infer that, you know, this group of hippie cultists invaded their home and then murdered him, his family, and tried to murder him. And he ended up with a pneumothorax, or a collapsed lung, and a chest tube, which helped correct that. And he's doing okay. But a lot of what he's stating was the, series of events is starting to conflict with the crime scene findings.
Mm-hmm.
And where we left off, the military police were telling the FBI that they could maybe call off the search about, you know, the hippies, because they're starting to realize that that is probably absurd and probably not the case. And even though we are just on the tail of the Manson family murders, and that, you know, that was a very real thing that did happen, that he was, allegedly trying to make it seem like that was the case here, that is becoming less and less likely. Yeah, exactly. So here we go.
I want to know how they squash this guy.
Oh, I know.
Here we go.
All right. So February 17th, 1970, like less than like a day after the killings of his wife and daughters, Jeffrey McDonald, who's 26, he's 26 years old.
Gosh, wow.
Lay in a bed at a hospital at Fort Bragg Military Base in North Carolina, and he was recovering from a lot of wounds, the vast majority of which, again, were very superficial and didn't even need stitches. There was one that was pretty significant, and he ended up, again, with a collapsed lung, so that, you know, was significant enough, but the vast majority of his wounds were extremely superficial. You know, before that evening in February, he had this, you know, wonderful life. He had these years of very prestigious medical training at multiple really highly sought after programs throughout the country. Mm-hmm. He ended up serving his country and went through basic training and then training to become a Green Beret, which is, you know, very highly elite group within the Army. And he was hoping to get deployed to somewhere with a lot of action, a lot of carnage, a lot of gore, a lot of explosions and paratrooping and all that fabulous stuff that he loved. And instead, he was stationed to be sort of a staff physician within Fort Bragg, and he was kind of disappointed about that. So by December of 1969, Colette, his wife, had gotten pregnant with their third child. And, you know, it was should have been a really joyous time.
I know.
But it seems like, you know, there was a little bit of strain on the relationship because he had had a lot of infidelities and he had strayed from their relationship multiple times over multiple years. And
I realized that when we were talking about his infidelities and this other stuff in the first episode, I called him a pig. And I just want to be clear that I did not write it on the headboard.
She did not. And she also did not know that that was coming. That was
I did
a total
not,
coincidence.
But I was like, oh, pig. Pig. Pig.
That was an interesting coincidence. Interesting coincidence.
As soon as you said that word pig when we did the last episode, I was like, well, that's random.
Yeah. So he had gone to police, obviously, and said, like, yeah, there were these four hippies. They were chanting. They said death to pigs. They wrote that on the headboard. They beat me until I was unconscious. So there was this huge manhunt, right? And the papers are even starting to publish and draw parallels between Colette and Sharon Tate, who was one of the very high profile victims of the Manson family murders.
Right. Yep.
So that's what's sort of circulating in the media right now, based on the crime scene evidence. His story is just not adding up.
Can you imagine being the FBI and you're just like, yeah, I think you can call off the dogs on trying to find the murderer. Mm-hmm. I think it's this guy. Like, can you imagine like trying to be like, I think you're looking out for the wrong type of person, you know?
No. And this guy is like a really prominent member of their community in this
place. I was going to say, yeah.
Place.
I mean, mm-hmm.
And yep. He really well respected. I mean, the guy is like a Green Beret. He's been to all the most, you know, prestigious institutions. He's got a fantastic resume, all of the high marks, all of the recommendations, and
living on a military base.
That's why this was so unbelievable. Now, that's part of why it was so hard for people to wrap their head around the fact that he might have actually done this. Okay, so the commanding officer of the criminal investigation at Fort Bragg, his name was Franz Grebner. And from the beginning, as soon as he stepped foot in that crime scene, he was one of the ones to like sort of put up his hand and be like, you guys, this crime scene is not making sense with what he's saying. Like, for
one, immediately, right? Like, just
right. Immediately. He's like, this guy says he dragged himself down the hall to perform CPR on his kids after he was bludgeoned and stabbed, yet there's no blood in the hall. There's no blood on the phones that he used to call 911. All of it just was quite glaringly not making physical sense. So he was the first one to be like, something is not right. He's not telling us everything. So within a few days, Grebner actually came to the belief that there had been no hippies. Instead, he started believing, like I said, that Jeffrey McDonald had likely murdered
there
his
are
own
no hippies.
Family because there was no other explanation that accounted for the way the crime scene looked, right? Were it up to Grebner, McDonald probably would have been arrested like literally days after the tragedy. But instead, you know, they did have to sort of like do their due diligence. And also, a crime of this magnitude, this doesn't really happen on military bases. And military police were pretty understaffed, pretty underprepared for something as complicated and controversial as this.
I believe it. Yeah.
And a lot of the officers on staff, you know, they don't work murder investigations. This is their jurisdiction, but this is not what they do on the day to day. Right. So, you know, it is pretty well reflected in the work that they did. And we're going to sort of unpack that
a little bit. Did they kind of like botch it?
Yeah, a little bit. There were parts that if this were, you know, if this investigation were conducted by a homicide unit from, you know, San Francisco, would have probably gone great and they would have gotten all of these things right. But it just wasn't dealt with that way, right?
Right.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel. I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
So now they were disorganized. First of all, they misplaced some evidence and they didn't keep a very good paper trail. Like one of the first rules when you're processing evidence is that there's this chain of custody, right? Yeah. So you pass it on from staff member to staff member and there's a paper trail that follows it so that the evidence itself is always within the custody of the department. And right. There's no question that it was ever tampered with or lost right. or anything was, you know, mm-hmm. messed with in any way. So they didn't really keep that paper trail and they did not keep the chain of custody intact on multiple things. So as a result, when we get to the trial, there's a lot of things that ended up being inadmissible, which is
I was
a
just
huge
gonna say,
detriment.
I was going to ask, like, because again, I know that this is in the 70s now, right?
Yeah.
Like early. Mm-hmm. So like in
we don't have DNA. Obviously.
In today's, you don't, but also in today's mm-hmm. standards, like it would be inadmissible. So I was just curious in the 70s if it was, but you just cleared
yeah.
that up.
Yeah, today it would be inadmissible and it was back then. I mean, they got pretty sophisticated with what they were doing back in the 70s. You know, you still had people that were learning and studying things like blood spatter patterns, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we had a really good grasp
That's
at that
so
point on anatomy.
To me. That
I've always loved
blood spatter. Yeah.
It is really its own specialty, and I only know that really because of Dexter. I love that show. Dexter is the best. But yeah, it really is. It's very much its own, you know, niche. There's all these sorts of interesting facets which make true crime in general really interesting to me. That's why I like this stuff, you know? Go ahead.
I don't know if you remember this, but way back in school, it was like our very last year, and I just needed like a general credit of something, and I mm-hmm. took a criminal justice class. Like our last semester, and it was so much mm-hmm. fun. And I remember when we were focusing on blood spatter and looking mm-hmm. at crime scene photos and whatnot, and it was just fascinating. It was absolutely
fascinating. It's so
interesting
what you can garner from just like a few drops of blood.
Correct.
You know?
Correct.
What was the velocity? Like, were they standing, sitting? Like, what was
the
weapon? The direction. Like, it's also, you can get so much information from a few drops of liquid, and that is like really interesting. At one point, actually, they found a boot print outside the house. And so they were trying to make a cast and they did it wrong and they ended up ruining the original print and it rendered it completely useless. Like it was stuff like this all along the way.
It's kind of making me think of the botched JonBenet Ramsey too. That crime scene, you know?
I know. Yeah. It's that. Oh my God. So that's like the one true crime case that I kind of have. I'm like a little bit, you know, irrationally obsessed with. And I've listened to so many. So don't get me going on that because I will make comments. Okay. And
but
yes,
right,
I know
that's what this
I
is.
I know that her name
of.
Is also in the Epstein files, which I've gone down that rabbit hole to you guys. Google it if you want. It's
okay.
pretty wild.
Now my mind is blown. What?
Yeah. So ugh. I digress.
I can't even.
Yep, I can't even. So there was that issue with the footprint. They also never went through the trash. That's like pretty basic. You go through the trash. Like see if he discarded anything. See if there mm-hmm. was any receipts for anything that is unusual. You go through that, but they forgot. And then when it finally occurred to them, the fucking trash had already been collected and it was impossible to trace. So mm-hmm. there was no evidence recovered from the trash. Even with their fuck-ups. There was a lot that they did recover, and there was a lot that was documented correctly. So, I mean, mm-hmm. they did have somewhat of a case. Mm-hmm. Now, Franz Grebner, the leader of the investigation, believed that his team had what they needed to essentially try the guy and get a conviction. They did collect hair, fibers, and, of course, blood samples from all around the house. They also found a surprising amount of prescription drugs in the house. And we knew that he was taking Escitrol, right? Which was the amphetamine to help him stay awake and maintain his energetic demeanor. And even for a physician who had ready, you know, access to all of these drugs, it was a exorbitant amount of prescription drugs in the house. Yeah, it was wild. Way more than they expected to find. Meanwhile, McDonald himself continued to recover and rest at Fort Bragg Hospital under the impression that authorities were looking for a bunch of hippies and nobody was, you know, any the wiser to what was going on. And this, you know, might have been because he was like sequestered from everything, stuck in the hospital, not keeping up with, you know, what was in the media. And, you know, nobody was, you know, somebody has to come talk to you for an update. So.
Mm-hmm.
He was dealing with his own medical issues. So, and we had talked about, you know, he had the collapsed lung and he had to have the tube replaced, and it was kind of a complicated situation. Now, February 26th, which was 9 days after the murders, is when Jeffrey McDonald was discharged from the hospital. And by the time he left, he noticed that the armed guards were gone, and he knew what that meant. The military no longer thought that he needed protecting. Because they had stationed armed guards outside of his room, thinking that he was being targeted for something, and he noticed that they were gone, and he knew immediately,
till that day,
they were outside his room. I guess they weren't like interacting with him, so he didn't really get to see until he actually physically left the room. So he knew immediately what that meant. It occurred to him, like, oh, okay, they
don't believe, you know, the hippie story.
They're not looking for the hippies, and he knew at that moment that he might be a suspect. So after he left the hospital, he started to grieve. And it was actually, you know, his grieving process was pretty believable and pretty what you would expect for a father who had lost his children and wife. And those around him, you know, didn't really see anything amiss with how he was behaving and how he was reacting. It seemed as though he was going through a very, you know, catastrophic grieving process. And he was granted leave from the base, and he journeyed with his mother to the coast of South Carolina, and they spent a few days out there.
I'm surprised that didn't get put a squash to it with the suspicions already. I'm just surprised. Yeah.
It might have just been that, you know, maybe they told him he can't leave the state, and he didn't leave the state. He just went to the coast with his mom and, you know, just took a couple of days. But it was also very early in the investigation. So he tried to kind of process the events, you know, per everybody that reported on how he was behaving. He also did have to communicate with his wife's parents, Colette's parents, who had requested that the bodies of Colette and the children be sent to them. So the bodies of Dr. McDonald's wife and children were transported back to New York State, where Colette's mother and stepfather, Mildred and Alfred Kassab, had arranged for their burial. What they wanted was for all of them to be buried in New York State, where they lived and where she was from originally. So the Kassabs hadn't really heard any concern or suggestions that Jeffrey might actually have committed the murders, because that really hadn't reached the media yet at all. Okay. They had sort of accepted the story that McDonald had told them. And again, it was believable because there were, you know, the Manson family existed. There were copycat crimes that happened, and that was something that was happening in the country. So
it wasn't
a far reach.
If the inconsistencies haven't really been out there yet, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
In the story and in the crime scene.
That was not public knowledge. Exactly.
Right.
So they fully accepted that story, and they had, you know, believed that their beloved children and child and grandchildren had been killed by a bunch of hippies.
Those poor parents.
I cannot freaking imagine. And they were really bothered by the possibility that they might not get justice, because they had not heard that these guys had been caught. And they knew that, you know, if these hippies are out there, they're probably vagrants. They are going to be hard to track, hard to trace, hard to find. And it was really bothersome to them that they might have really gotten really far away, and that we very realistically might not figure out who did this. So they took solace in the fact that Jeffrey had lived, though. And they thought maybe he has some more information that he hasn't really been able to access yet because he's grieving or traumatized. And there might be something that he knows or is able to provide that might help solve this case.
I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah. And so investigators had the same thought. You know, if he didn't do this, he probably has more information that we just haven't been able to get out of him quite yet. And members of the Army Criminal Investigation Division struggled to find evidence against McDonald that was more than circumstantial. So, like, everything that they had now was not physical evidence. They did have his fingerprints on what was one of the murder weapons, right?
But he had also made a point
to state to the cops that he had taken that knife out of his wife's chest. So, yes, of course, his fingerprints would be on it. So they needed tangible physical evidence of guilt, right? Mm-hmm. The investigation was slow, partly because of the inexperience of the people at the helm. And so that was, you know, a big obstacle in all of this. And suddenly there was a discovery that was kind of surprising and a potential break in the case. Each member of the McDonald family had a different blood type. And this is actually somewhat unusual for a family of four, both with both the same parents. Jeffrey McDonald was type B. Colette was type A. Kimberly was AB, which is one of the rarest blood types. And Kristen was type O. So they all had the four different types of blood.
That's interesting,
right? Isn't that fascinating? So this is helpful because at this point, again, they don't have DNA, but they are able to identify throughout the house whose blood is whose based on the Rh type. So at least they have that, right?
Yeah.
So with this, you know, blood types can be critical to investigations, and they were at this time because, again, we did not have DNA. Blood typing was all that they had, really.
Wow.
So, I know.
I love this stuff.
It's really interesting. So blood types are determined by the types of antigens that are in our blood, and specifically they look for the presence or absence of the A and B antigens, which sit on the surface of red blood cells. And they're foreign proteins that can trigger the immune system to create antibodies to fight against them. And scientists also look for a protein in the blood called the rhesus factor or the Rh factor, derived from the rhesus monkey, which is how we first discovered Rh typing in the first place back in the 1920s and 1930s.
The monkey.
So, and it can be positive or negative depending on whether the antigens are present or absent. That's what that infers. And people either have A antigens, B antigens, both A and B antigens, or neither A and B antigen, which would make them type O. And the four groups can all be either positive or negative. So in total, there are eight different blood types that are possible.
I'm A negative, by the way. I just wanted to share that.
I'm B positive because I be positive.
Because you are positive. That fits you.
It does, doesn't it?
I'm A negative, Nelly.
Oh, my God. All right. So in truth, there's actually a lot of other like very minor antigens that we have since discovered that can make blood typing really complicated. And they're actually like kind of rare, and it can make transfusing kind of risky and complicated, which is why, you know, in the hospital setting, every time you transfuse someone, pretty much every 72 hours, 48, 72 hours, you have to get the type and screen, right? Uh-huh, every single time. It's frustrating, but there's a reason for it, right? So the most common blood type is actually O positive, and people with O negative blood are considered the universal donors. Now, O negative means you have the absence of both antibodies, and that makes your blood amenable to, like, you can
give it to anyone.
Literally give it to anybody because there are no antibodies in your blood.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole blood typing thing and the genealogy behind it is really interesting to me because there's certain combinations of people that can and can't have certain blood type children, which, again, is really interesting to me. That's a whole different specialty. So that makes figuring out whose blood is where in the house a lot easier, knowing that all four people in the house had different blood types because there was blood everywhere. And this
That's so intriguing.
With this, they were able to really construct who was where and potentially at what time based on the layering, too, of like the spatter on spatter. You know, that kind of builds a timeline.
Without having DNA, that's pretty...
That's fucking impressive. That's really cool.
Yeah.
So I think it's, you know, that is enormous potential, you know, for investigators to really build a timeline of like at least a rough timeline or an estimate of how this went down and like actually formulate some tangible theories. So, again, there was fucking blood everywhere. Mm-hmm. This was their existing suspicion that McDonald had like lied about what actually transpired during these attacks. By mid-March, the investigators determined that the blood by the entrance to the master bedroom was, in fact, from Kimberly McDonald. And some of the blood found inside Kristen's bedroom belonged to Colette. So he never mentioned that Colette had made it to one of the kids' bedrooms. That was not part of the story. In his story, she was killed in the bedroom. He woke up with people standing around them and he fought them. He got up and fought them into the living room and then they took off. And then he found his dead wife, who had allegedly been like bludgeoned and stabbed in the bed next to the bed on the floor. So there was never really any reason for Colette or her blood to have been in the kid's room at all if what he's saying is true. So that's another inconsistency. The blood from Jeffrey McDonald was only found in large amounts in two places, the kitchen and the hallway bathroom by the sink. It was not found. Again, there was no blood in the living room where he said this attack took place, which is extremely unusual.
And then across, nor going was it down found, the hallway, crawling.
Exactly. Yeah. There was nothing in the hallway. And there was zero of his blood in his children's bedrooms, where he said he went into each bedroom and tried to render aid and give CPR to his children. And none of his blood was found in there after he had been stabbed and was like hemorrhaging everywhere. No. So finally, the investigators had their hard evidence that McDonald was at the very least not telling the whole truth. At the very least, his story is not adding up, right? And this is tangible. This is not circumstantial. By the first week of April 1970, about 6 weeks after the murders, 26-year-old Dr. Jeffrey picked up shifts at the local emergency room, and everyone there seemed to accept his story about the hippies wholeheartedly. But for a moment, reacclimating to life seemed possible. And then, in April, McDonald was summoned to the office of the Criminal Investigation Division for a meeting. McDonald showed up in uniform. I think it seems like he was kind of expecting, like, a friendly update or, like, you know, a little bit of a, you know, what's going on with the investigation, but not necessarily that they're going to share, you know, their findings that support a completely different narrative. Because, on the contrary, he walked into, a total interrogation. So Franz Grebner and two younger officers greeted McDonald, and he noticed that he had already set up a microphone and tape recorder. And as McDonald sat down, Grebner said, "Can you tell your story again from the beginning? I need to know every detail from the beginning with this tape recorder in place." And he informed McDonald of his rights. And at that moment, McDonald was like, "Oh, if you're reading me my rights, I'm getting, this is an interrogation."
Yep.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
So still, he launched into his story. He hit all of those same points that he had made before. He said he had woken up to seeing the hippies looming over him. I'm sorry, he was not in the bed. He was in the living room because he had fallen asleep in the living room on the couch. So he said he woke up with hippies standing all around him, with him in the living room. He had heard his wife and children screaming. He tried to get to them, but was intercepted by the hippies in the living room. And there he was stabbed and he was beaten with a bat until he was unconscious. When he came to, he discovered that his family was dead. and the investigators asked him to repeat the account with more details. And they started kind of like, look, you know, asking about the little cuts in his abdomen and, you know, asking, you know, why, you know, do you think that they only cut you like this little bit? I mean, these are literally little surface cuts. Like, why do you think that the injuries to your wife and children were so severe? And yours, apart from the one injury that gave you that pneumothorax, are pretty surface level.
Right.
So they start really kind of focusing on these minutiae that are very, very important. Their questions started to get sharper, and it soon became clear that they were sort of implying that he was not giving them the full story. And he starts realizing the direction that this is going, and he starts quickly denying any involvement in the murders.
I was going to say, did he just like start tensing up? And
yeah, he got really tense. He started getting defensive, and he was like, nope, we're not doing this. I did not have anything to do with this. But Grebner, the investigator, did not let this change his mind. He started kind of hammering home all the details that they found in the investigation of the crime scene and how absurd his story seemed with those findings, right? You know, one, and he wondered out loud, you know, if you're implying that those hippies, you think they were on drugs, what drugs do you think they would have taken that would have led them in this direction and, you know, pushed them to do something like this? And McDonald drew on his past experience as an ER doctor. And he explained that young drug users often were unclear on what they'd taken. He said it literally could have been anything. I mean, and he's not wrong. You know, a lot of people that purchase and take street drugs don't really know what it's cut with and don't know what's in it.
Right.
So he said, you know, it could have been any number of things. Could have been LSD, could have been amphetamines. And he did not commit to any one drug in particular, instead claiming that it could have been anything. LSD, mescaline, peyote, speed, anything. Whatever they were on, he claimed, you know, it caused them to, you know, be frenzied in their attack, and they were violent, they were irrational. And then with that, investigators were like, huh, well, you know, you have a lot of prescription drugs in your house, you know. But McDonald reassured them that, yes, I have a lot of pill bottles. Some of them contain the Escitrol, which I do take from time to time, but the other ones are all for medical purposes. I take them all because they all pertain to my personal medical issues. Investigators were not convinced.
It's a lot of issues.
It is. They start probing a little bit more about that, and they start talking about, you know, the fibers from his pajama jacket, for instance, which were found beneath Colette's body. Despite McDonald's claims that he came across her when she was already dead on the floor and had not moved her. How would those fibers have gotten under her body?
Yeah.
Right? So another inconsistency, right? So McDonald claimed, well, I don't know, you know, the science behind the fibers and how they could have transferred, you know, to beneath her body. I have no idea. And he started getting like really nervous and evasive to these questions. And interviewers then started like really probing again. They started stretching out the interviews and called him back the following day. And eventually the investigators said outright that they thought that he committed the murders. This.
Look at my face.
It. Devin's got a face going. This flustered the shit out of him. He was like, oh,
good.
He started like vehemently denying the accusation, even agreed to take a polygraph test. He said, give me like, let's do this polygraph test. I will take it today or tomorrow or the next day, whenever you can arrange it. So as soon as he walked out of Grebner's office, McDonald realized that a polygraph test was a risk he could not afford to take somehow. So 10 minutes.
Oh, that's kind of stupid.
He kind of thought on it for about 10 minutes. 10 minutes after he left, he called the investigators and he said, you know what? I actually don't want to take a polygraph or something like that. It's not in my best interest.
I thought about it. And,
you know. I've really prayed on this, okay? And I just cannot seem to. It's like, bro, this was your fucking idea. Okay, whatever.
Gosh.
Whatever, dude. So he had decided he was not going to accidentally help the investigators anymore. So he instead went and he got himself a really fancy lawyer. And later that afternoon, the provost marshal of Fort Bragg formally announced that Jeffrey McDonald was their prime suspect in the murder of his family.
Now it's in the news.
Yep. No charges had been filed yet, but McDonald was being relieved of his duties, both as a physician and an officer, while the investigation was underway. And the high-profile attorney that he hired was a guy out of Philadelphia. His name was Bernard Siegel. And over the next few weeks, Siegel and McDonald kind of went through a battery of psychological testing to sort of gauge what his mental state was and what his mental state could have been the night of the murders. So what he needed to know was if McDonald was capable of killing his family. Did he have any features of mental illness that would support him being capable of something like this, right? Because not everybody could do this, thankfully. Doctors all reported that. I guess it is a good thing. The doctors all reported back to Siegel that McDonald was healthy and stable. One psychologist actually wrote that he believed the crime was probably committed by a psychotic or criminal psychopath, and he did not believe McDonald was either of those things. So that's an interesting tidbit. Now, again, we talked a little bit about how we thought, you know, maybe there's a antisocial personality disorder, you know, or psychopathy, or perhaps an episode of psychosis brought on by the amphetamines he was using that could have driven something like this. But that would kind of mean, especially if he was in a state of psychosis, it means their brain is not processing information correctly. He would not be able to come up with this alternative story and try to cover his tracks. That would not
say,
be a feature
like
of that.
In the last episode, when you first described it to me, it kind of gave me the vibes of the sleepwalking. You know what I mean?
100%.
Like it was giving me a lot of
that
those vibes.
Unhinged, that brutal. But this guy is covering his tracks and there's evidence that he's lying. Like, that is for sure. He is not telling the truth. So with all these doctors giving these really positive reports, Bernie, his lawyer, took comfort in believing that he was likely defending this, you know, innocent guy who's kind of getting railroaded here. So Bernie Siegel prepared McDonald's defense and the military investigators got their ducks in the row for court. And about a month or two after McDonald's interrogation, they were ready to proceed with the case. And in May 1st, 1970, the U.S. Army official officially charged 26-year-old Dr. Jeffrey McDonald with 3 counts of murder. Now, the American military legal system works very differently than our civilian legal system works. So, like, if one of us were accused of murder, we would get charged. We would then go to trial with a jury of our peers, right? And they would face judgment from the jury, and there would be a verdict from the jury of our peers, which would then get sentenced by the presiding judge, right? Instead of that, when cases in the military legal system reach trial, they face judgment from a jury of officers chosen by the military lawyers. So it's a little bit different. It's not like a jury of lay people. These are all military personnel that are participating.
You can't handle the truth.
Exactly. And because the jury was essentially chosen by the prosecution themselves, Bernie Siegel believed, oh, this is going to be easy. Like, he's going to get out of this no problem. We're going to be able to convince them, you know, no problem. So his strategy was to make McDonald's case, you know, before it even ever reached trial, staging this defense during a pretrial Article 32 hearing. And this is usually a simple procedural step where an appointed investigative officer hears the evidence and then authorizes military lawyers to then try the case, right? But Siegel, soon after the Article 32 hearing began, Siegel just trotted out a shitload of witnesses who testified on the forensic negligence that took place, on how the collection of evidence was super sloppy, all the things that they missed, the garbage, the footprint, everything that, you know, was detrimental to the case.
Yep. I mean,
so he was just parading them in front of the tribunal.
It's good.
And
so he's
in
doing
particular,
his job, at least.
He is. I mean, this guy's a shark, it seems like. And in particular, Siegel emphasized their failure to find any footprints in the house, which was a critical finding or non-finding. Because, you know, if what he's saying is true, is like these people, you know, came in from outside, right? There should have been footprints found in the house, but forensics did not find those. So he claimed, like, that was negligence. Like, there were footprints in the house, but forensics didn't even look for them because they're negligent. Their negligence in preserving the crime scene, he claimed, made it completely impossible for the true culprits to be found, essentially. And the scant amount of evidence that did exist was muddied by sloppy investigative work. So it was like he was raising the question, can you even trust the evidence that we have with how sloppy everybody was? Which I get. You know, that's actually that's kind of valid. So to further defend his client, Siegel brings out the psychiatrists and doctors who all testified to McDonald's healthy mental state and his good character, his accomplishments through life. You know, like, in what universe would this guy who had everything going for him annihilate his family in this, you know, crazy moment?
Do you have anything on what side his wife's family was on? Like, were they for
or against
him?
We get into it.
Yeah, we get into it.
Mm-hmm. Yep, there's more to come on that. In fact, perhaps most convincing was Colette's stepfather, Freddie Kassab, who took the stand to defend his stepson-in-law.
Okay, yep.
It was an overwhelming show of force for the defense, and the prosecution was utterly unprepared for this challenge. So their job was about to get harder. And in August of 1970, a month into the Article 32 proceedings, a 22-year-old delivery man by the name of William Posey approached Bernie Siegel, his lawyer, at the motel where he was staying. Posey knew that Mildred and Freddie Kassab were offering $5,000 for anybody who had information about their daughter's murder. And it seems he was hoping to cash in on that. He told Siegel that he knew a woman who matched McDonald's description of one of the murderer's hippies, like this female that was with them. The woman, he said, was 18-year-old Helena Stokely. And this lady was Posey's neighbor in what was known at the time as the hippie district of nearby Fayetteville. And she seemed to fit the description of McDonald's killer perfectly, of what he described her as. Uh-huh. Posey described her as this lady who looked gaunt, like she was a drug addict, and that she wore a floppy hat and she had long blonde hair or a blonde wig on. And Posey claimed that at 4 a.m.
I feel like that could be like half the hippie, female hippie population. I mean, I'm just saying.
Genuinely. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And Posey claimed that at 4 a.m. on February 17th, the morning after the murders, he witnessed Stokely arrive back at her house in a delirious state. According to him, she'd been dropped off by a car which had two or three men inside. And Posey added that in the weeks afterwards, Stokely abruptly stopped wearing her wig and floppy hat and even informed Posey that she was high on LSD and mescaline that specific night. He also claimed that Stokely had once said that she and her boyfriend couldn't get married until they had killed some more people, quote unquote.
Okay.
So Bernie Siegel immediately is like, I like you. I am going to involve you in this whole situation.
Guy.
You are my guy. So he brings William Posey into the Article 32 hearing, where Posey gets on the stand. He repeats all of his claims about Helena Stokely. The investigators knew Stokely well, actually. Very well-established lady with the law, I guess, as it turned out. Not only was she the daughter of a former lieutenant stationed at Fort Bragg, but she also worked as a drug informant for the Fayetteville police. So this is somebody who's, like, well-established in the system.
She's also credible.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. She herself is credible. So even though Stokely admitted drug use and confirmed for investigators that she did occasionally wear a blonde wig and a floppy hat, they did not take the allegations seriously, essentially. They were simply convinced that McDonald was the perp, but McDonald still was putting up a fight tooth and nail. Huh. Now, he actually was very vocal to reporters, very vocal to news outlets, and he very much sensationalized and publicized his own trial in the newspapers, on television, everywhere to spread his side of the story, which is kind of unusual behavior for somebody who's guilty, right? I'm just saying, devil's advocate, for the most part, why are you drawing more attention to yourself? Unless, I mean, maybe not. I could be wrong. I could be very wrong. I've never been guilty of something like that, thankfully. But he actually started receiving a lot of support from the general public in response to this, who now believed he'd been wrongly accused. And the strong defense critiquing the poorly conducted crime scene sweep, the discovery of Helena Stokely's potential involvement, and the public attention on the case all turned the tide right against the prosecution, who was kind of fumbling this to begin with.
What a mess.
On October 14th, 1970, 2 days after his 27th birthday, The colonel in charge of the Article 32 hearing, Warren Rock, made his final recommendations. So Rock had declared that McDonald was innocent and the charges against him should be dropped, and that he suggested that a civilian investigator should be looking into Helena Stokely. The Army did not publicly reveal these recommendations, nor did they continue to pursue Stokely or any of the claims made by this guy that came forward, Posey. But they did drop all of the charges against Jeffrey. As the dust settled, McDonald just kind of basked in his glory and his victory and his win.
What the hell?
In December 1970, he was granted an honorable discharge from the military.
Bullshit.
And he celebrated by making a friendly and sympathetic appearance on the Dick Cavett Show, which was one of the most watched late night shows in the country.
That's odd.
And he turned on the charm, he talked about the case, and he focused on getting on with his life. But Colette's mom and stepfather, Mildred and Freddie Kassab, who were still mourning their daughter and grandchildren, watched this television appearance. And, you know, as they did not have the culprit, as everything was still sort of essentially unsolved, they were totally unsatisfied. They were okay with the fact that McDonald had been exonerated, but the job wasn't done, according to them.
Exactly. Yeah, of course.
So,
which, fair, I would be the same.
Totally. They were still super motivated and still really needed to find the killers and bring them to justice. And to make matters worse, you know, they were following the trial and they noticed the lies that McDonald told about the extent of his injuries, that he was overstating the number of wounds that he said. And he actually told them at one point that he almost died, which was like not the truth. He was not close to death. He was sick for like a minute, but they fixed him. And the Kassabs are starting to come around to the possibility that he could be lying about everything. And McDonald is starting to lose their support as a result. So they start wondering, you know, what else is he willing to lie about? So they started considering the possibility that he could actually have done this.
I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Want to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step 1, download Rocket Money. Step 2, link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step 3, tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step 4, create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
And at the start of 1971, nearly a year after the murder of his family, 27-year-old Jeffrey McDonald starts, you know, planning this new life for himself. Soon he started talking about moving to California, returning to hospital work, potentially doing a residency so he could get a board certification now that he had been discharged from the Army. But back in New York, Mildred and Freddie Kassab, did not give up, and they were determined to find their daughter and grandkids' killer. Colette's stepfather, Freddie, became kind of obsessed about the entire situation, which I think I probably would too. I think that's a valid obsession, yep, honestly. Yep. He was convinced that the only way forward with the investigation was obtaining the transcript from the entire Article 32 hearing. Because he had followed the, you know, what was in the media. He had followed little bits and pieces, but he couldn't be there for the entire thing. And it was never made public because that's like all, that's the military's jurisdiction.
Right, sure.
His relationship with Jeffrey had deteriorated, obviously, because he's now suspecting that Jeffrey might have been involved at this mm-hmm. part. And McDonald did absolutely nothing to help his in-laws get copies of the transcript. So that, you know, created more of a distance between them. And he seemed to kind of, once this was all over, he was apathetic. You know, he started coming off as like, you know, you guys can worry all you want, but I'm going to move on with my life now. And her parents are kind of
like,
thinking,
your children are dead.
But your kids are dead, and we still don't know who did this. If you didn't, why don't you give a flying fuck about yep. finding the murderer of your pregnant wife and your two very young kids? That's what right. I want to know. So all super duper valid. Finally, in February of 1971, the Army complied with the request and allowed Freddie Kassab to receive his very own copy of the hearing transcript. So he went through every single word of this once it arrived, and he drew his own conclusion, which that was that Jeffrey McDonald blatantly lied about multiple things regarding this investigation, the crime scene, and the events of that night. Like the investigators before, Kassab had seen a lot of inconsistencies, a lot of mistruths, and his behavior, his demeanor, which all was more consistent that he was hiding something than mm-hmm. a guy who was grieving and trying to tell the truth. So McDonald, again, he had claimed that he was beaten far worse than he actually was, that he was injured far worse than he actually was. He claims that he heard his wife and daughter cry out for him, but then, you know, that they were already mortally wounded before he even woke up. So, like, how were they crying if they were already dead in that timeline? You know, a lot of these little inconsistencies were just adding up. It's so chilling to think about this. Now, on March 28th of 1971, Freddie Kassab returned to Fort Bragg, and he actually walked through the home himself for the first time after the crimes. And he walked through each and every room. He stayed for hours. He examined every inch of the house with the help of two Army investigators. And when he emerged from the house, Freddie Kassab had zero doubt on who was responsible for the murders, and it was
really?
Jeffrey. Yeah. Just based on, you know, he was trying to run through every possible scenario in his head, and he's walking mm-hmm. every path in that house. You know, how right. would this work if it happened this way? And
correct.
It just didn't make sense. That right. he could not make it make sense the way Jeff was telling the story.
He's just trying to find anything, like, make it make
yes,
sense, and it's not working.
Make it make sense, and he could not make it make sense. So he had to find a way to take his former son-in-law out of, you know, California and get him back here and figure this shit out. However, McDonald is still fighting, and he's continuing to make everything really difficult and doesn't seem really interested in finding the killers of his family. So in the summer of 1971, 27-year-old Jeff McDonald, again, had moved across the country. He was in Long Beach, California, where he had returned to medicine. And he actually had gotten a residency in emergency medicine at St. Mary's Medical Center. And after only 6 months, he actually got a promotion and was the chief resident among his peers. And he was super charming. All of his coworkers said that he seemed like this really nice guy, just so charismatic, and just like all of these guys that we talk about, you know, nobody would ever suspect anything of them because they just seem like such great people. You know, that's what we hear. He was writing papers, he was writing medical literature, he was publishing articles, he was contributing to textbooks, like medical textbooks. Actually, some of his works are still like floating around out there in medical literature. And he actually joined the board of directors of the local American Heart Association, and he co-founded the American Trauma Society, which within a few years, he was like one of the most beloved doctors in Long Beach, and he had made quite a reputation for himself there among the community. And he, again, had become this guy with like this unimpeachable moral character, right? So that, again, makes everybody want to look the other way and make them want to believe his side of the story. But if you look at the evidence,
don't do it.
You cannot make it make sense any other way. Freddy Kassab was relentless.
Good.
He started positioning the Justice Department to get him back to North Carolina, and he staged a public relations assault on the Army. He brought newspaper advertisements. He wrote letter after letter after letter demanding they reopen the investigation.
You go,
Dad. The
fight
dragged on for literal years. Fast forward to 1974. So it's been years
this
point.
Yeah.
It's been 4 years since the murders. The Justice Department finally relented. This guy did not fucking give up, and it shows. In August, they impaneled a grand jury in Raleigh, North Carolina, to investigate the McDonald case. And 30-year-old Jeffrey McDonald was fucking outraged. He was like, will you just fucking drop it already? The law already said I had nothing to do with it. I've been exonerated. Leave me the shit alone, dude. He could not believe that he had to leave his comfy, beautiful life in Long Beach, California, and take a fucking jog down memory lane and actually deal with the fact that his entire life was ruined and his family was murdered a couple of years ago. He could not believe that he had to deal with all that. He was called to testify. Such a fucking inconvenience. He could not believe that he had to do this. He had to go testify, and he could not even, he wasn't even bothered enough to like hide the fact that he was fucking pissed to be there and annoyed to be there and resentful of this whole process. On the stand, he was hostile. He was dismissive of everybody's concern. And that just made him look like a bigger fucking asshole. So he was just, you know, damaging his own defense at that point. And while McDonald continued to repeat that same story of the hippie attackers, the prosecution offered their own interpretation of the evidence. And in January of 75, FBI analyst Paul Stomber testified on what he believed happened based on the physical evidence. That night, inside the McDonald household, Colette and Jeffrey got into a fight in the master bedroom. McDonald may have struck Colette first, causing her nose to bleed or causing an injury that was bleeding. Stomber then speculated that in response, Colette picked up a club and hit McDonald with it, explaining the small wound, the tiny wound that he had on his head that he claimed the hippies hit him over the head and then he lost consciousness. McDonald then got enraged and he took the club away from his wife. And then Stomber said that he believed McDonald swung his arm back and hit Colette, accidentally hitting Kimberly, who happened to be standing behind him in the doorway. Her injury may have been fatal in that moment, actually.
Oh, God.
And Stomber suggested that McDonald, realizing what he had done, then just panicked and killed the rest of the family. And
like, use the last one as like a...
Yes.
To add to like, the story.
What am I going to do in order to cover
the
this up?
Part of the
I have to kill everybody. Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
So how heartbreaking is this whole thing?
I cannot
even wrap my head around. This guy is just the biggest monster I've ever. This is insane. And he said, you know, he realized what he had done after he had killed the rest of his family. And then he inflicted all these injuries on himself, like the punctured thoracic cavity, to give himself that defense before calling the police and eventually covering it all up. And the grand jury was very easy to convince after that testimony. And on January 24th of 1975, they indicted Jeffrey McDonald on 3 counts of murder. Uh-huh. And in California, federal police took him into custody. And 5 years after the murders, McDonald was finally going to face an actual trial to determine his guilt or innocence. And it was time for the actual court battle to begin. A civilian court battle to begin.
I was
going to
say, this one's civilian.
So McDonald called on his lawyer from the initial case, Bernie Siegel, to defend him once again. And Siegel's strategy remained essentially unchanged. He said, you know, I'd like to get to a point where we can just avoid a trial altogether. So he started working his magic. He started challenging the indictment itself, claiming the lengthy court process was denying McDonald his Sixth Amendment right to a speedy trial. And the appeals court agreed, actually, and threw out the indictment initially. But in response, the prosecution appealed that ruling. Finally, in 1978, that appeal was successful, and it actually pushed the case through to reaching the Supreme Court. So what everybody, what McDonald and his lawyer really didn't want to happen was finally happening.
Yeah.
Now, the Supreme Court unanimously overruled all of the appeals court's decisions to dismiss the charges. And in 1979, nearly a decade after the murders, 36-year-old Jeffrey McDonald entered that courtroom to face the charges for the murder of his wife and kids.
Wow.
And the trial went similarly to the grand jury 4 years later, when McDonald and his lawyers maintained that story and challenged all the sloppy investigative work and all the lost evidence and XYZ. McDonald's defense again offered Helena Stokely as an alternate suspect, even calling her to testify. But Stokely, as it turns out, was an extremely unreliable narrator. She was too drugged up to really say where she was on the night of the murder. She could not give an accurate account. She really was very disorganized and could not provide any meaningful contribution to their case. So McDonald's lawyers then tried to call in six additional witnesses who had claimed they had heard Stokely confess to the killings in years since. Now, when FBI agents interviewed her, however, Stokely recanted all of those confessions that she'd made. And the judge determined that anything Stokely allegedly said was probably too untrustworthy and barred the witnesses to her confessions from taking any stand whatsoever. So that was huge. And that piece in particular is why the rest of this is so controversial. Because instead of going and checking with these witnesses and verifying their story, that was never done. One guy, one judge said, "You're too untrustworthy. We can't take anything you say to heart." When honestly, it's very unlikely, but it's not impossible that Stokely had something to do with this. And there were witnesses saying that they had heard her say, heard her confess to the murders, which she then recanted, but they never checked it out.
Give you a little bit of that.
It's reasonable doubt.
I was going to say, is it reasonable?
Like, it might not be reasonable, but it could have been if they had checked it out. They had to check it out. You check everything out, but they'd never followed up on any of those leads. So that's why a lot of this is so controversial. Now, that was sort of like one of the final nails in the coffin of the defense. And when Jeffrey took the stand, he was not hostile. He actually was more stoic. He was emotionless. And the tapes of the initial interrogations were replayed during the trial. And he was sort of like histrionic, you know, pretending to choke back tears and this, that, and the other thing, as you spoke of his murdered family, even though it was such a drag that he had to come back out this way to participate in a fucking trial about the whole situation. But the jury was totally unconvinced of his performance. It actually made them suspect more that he was a liar. They thought it was very performative and they thought it was very theatrical and just not in keeping with, you know, his normal demeanor. So on August 29th of 79, after 6.5 hours of deliberation, the jury reached a final verdict and they found Jeffrey McDonald guilty on two counts of second degree murder for the deaths of Colette and Kimberly and one count of first degree murder for the death of Kristen.
Wow.
So, yeah. Freddie and Mildred Kassab finally had answers and retribution and maybe some justice for their lost loved ones. Immediately after the verdict, they had announced that to the press that they now feel like their family members can rest in peace.
Oh my gosh.
Jeffrey McDonald was shocked as he was handcuffed and actually had to face the consequences of his actions. And the battle was actually not over for him. Throughout the next four decades, Dr. Jeffrey McDonald continued to maintain his innocence. He filed every possible appeal, spoke to every possible willing news outlet, made all the attempts to get things overturned, to get out of jail, to get early release. He never once broke, never once confessed to anything, always stuck to his story. And he finally exhausted his options in December of 2018. He consistently tried to get the public on his side to no real avail. And during the trial, McDonald actually invited a young author named Joe McGinnis to write a book detailing his side of the story. And that kind of backfired a little bit because McGinnis eventually came to believe that McDonald was guilty based on what he had learned.
Everyone so he was like, you're guilty, sorry. I'm not publishing this book.
The book became a bestseller, FYI, regarding his guilt. But there are still people out there that feel like McDonald is innocent, or at the very least, argued that evidence for his defense was ignored and not properly processed, which I don't think they're wrong. I don't think they're wrong.
Right.
In looking at everything, I have an opinion. I think he did it.
Same.
I think he did it. There's just too many inconsistencies. There's physical evidence that he's not telling the truth, and there's physical evidence to support the theory that the FBI analyst told during the trial.
Right. I completely agree.
But the fact that Helena Stokely was never fully investigated and that her alleged confessions
this
were never heard by a jury.
So familiar.
Yeah, you probably have heard about this.
They make a Lifetime movie out of this or something.
Oh, I don't know. Maybe. But it remains a point of contention because she allegedly made further confessions, including one to her mother before she died in 1983 from pneumonia and cirrhosis, that her mother never publicly revealed the confession until 2007. So that throws a chink in things. So the McDonald case remains incredibly controversial. I don't know for sure. I have an opinion, but I don't know for sure. His behavior says a lot, is all I'm going to say. Although I've never grieved to that extent, and people grieve differently. People have different processes. There's shock. You know, there's people how we process immense grief. I don't know how to process grief like that because I've never experienced it. I'm fortunate. But I just can't get past the evidence that was found.
I think if he didn't do it, I think he would have better reasons for the inconsistencies that he does.
Yes.
Because
I think so
to just hold your ground of this is the truth, this is what happened, your evidence is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like if he sticking to that is so unlikely. You know what I mean?
Very
like
much
it's
so.
Just for it to be that incredibly, yes, they made some mistakes and whatnot that I think do create reasonable doubt. So whether or not he,
yes.
you know, so whether or not a conviction should have happened, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But I think he would have been able to produce, like, if he really truly didn't do it, he would have been able to prove some other different reason as to why there were so many inconsistencies.
I also think that he was probably acting very out of character for his normal MO. As a human being, the night of the murders, because he had been very sleep deprived, he had been abusing Escitrol, and is it possible that he had such a lapse in judgment and, you know, such a, you know, a moment of, you know, loss of his faculties that he could have done this and then panicked? You know, it's not impossible that that this happened. It's also, you know, not impossible that maybe he was railroaded. You know, the evidence wasn't processed correctly. We know that a lot of the evidence wasn't processed correctly. What if all of it wasn't processed correctly? It's not, I think his behavior says a lot, but it's hard to say
for
sure.
What if him and Helena were doing it in the living room? And so she was there and got caught by the daughter and then just shit happened, you know?
Yes. Exactly.
I mean, maybe she was involved somehow, but
maybe.
Along with him.
And
you know?
I still think we don't know the whole story. We just don't know. We'll never know. You know what I mean?
No.
Currently, he is serving his sentence at a federal prison in Cumberland, Maryland. He reportedly had the opportunity to request parole in 2020, but as of today, he is still in prison. And in order to be granted parole, McDonald is required to admit guilt. That's pretty standard, right? To accept
right.
responsibility for your crimes and show remorse, mm-hmm. right? But he still, to this day, so many years later, will not confess. That's there's something to be said for that, too. Is he that narcissistic or did he just really not do it? This is the more I talk about it, the more I'm like, this is kind of a tough one, dude.
No, he did it.
50 years he's maintained his own innocence. 50 years. He refuses to confess.
I think he's that much of a narcissist.
He probably is.
He probably is. I think he is.
Maybe he has been performing since 1970 and the performance just continues. It's possible. The show lives on to this day. And McDonald continues to make the outlandish claim that one day he will walk free. He says, I will be a free man. One of these days, I will be a free man. He
don't
still
know about
says
that,
that,
dude. I wonder what Kim Kardashian thinks about this case.
I would love to know.
And her innocence
project. Please don't
project.
Pardon this guy. I don't feel good about it. You know? So anyway, that is the wild, crazy story.
I mean, this one brings up a lot of questions. Wow. Lots of questions to be had. But I'm going to stick to my opinion, and I think he did it.
I have an opinion. I also, though, I don't think I'm 100% because how can you be?
Thank you for listening, everyone. You can check us out on Facebook at Med Crimes Podcast.
You can find us on YouTube at Med Crimes Podcast.
Check us out on Instagram at Med Crimes Podcast.
If you want to become a Patreon, you can find us at www.patreon.com/medcrimespodcast.
Keep sending us your story ideas, anything you want to tell us, anything that you might want us to talk about one day, because we use them, especially when it's time
sure
to like,
do.
What do we talk about?
Us.
At medcrimes@gmail.com.
Stay safe out there. Keep washing your hands. Everything is flying around. Just wash your damn hands, okay?
Don't
Love
kill
ya.
People.
Let's not do that. Bye.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel. I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result,
My savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel. The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel. The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.